Blog Talk Radio.
I am Jim Dacian. I am author of the book Stay Up Los Angeles Street Art, and what you're listening to is a series of interviews with the artists themselves that went into writing this. And on the phone, I have the unforgettable Smear, who has been a leading figure in the graffiti and street art world, and I'm just really pleased to have him on the phone. On top of that, he also wrote the foreword for Stay Up, and it's a beautiful foreword. And so I need to thank you on two accounts, Smear. One, for writing, and two, for being here. Thanks so much.
Hey, what's going on? Nice to have me on the show.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So, you know, let's start with some basics, if we could. Could you tell us a little bit about the origins of the name Smear and a little bit about how you got into this world?
Right. Well, the name was given to me by my best friend's older brother. He was writing Smear years ago, and there was another guy from his tagging crew that wrote Smear, and they had a meeting, I guess, and one thing led to another, and Smear ended up getting punched out by Smear, and then he came home with, like, nursing a black eye, and I was a little kid, you know. He's like, hey, man, you know, do you want to write Smear? And I was like, I was looking for a name. I was writing stupid things at the time, things like Gizmo, Shreds, you know, little kid stuff. And then I was like, dude, yeah, for sure, I'll take it. And that's how I got the name. I've held on to it. This was like 1991, early 1992. And
wow.
Yeah, I've held on to the name ever since. And, you know, ever since then, I didn't start all crazy right away. I still, you know, started kind of smallish, I guess, and then it just built, you know, just kept at it, repetition, doing more bigger and bigger things and more brazen stuff, and then, you know, built up a history.
Yeah, and it seems like, it stuck, and it becomes part of your identity. Even your website now, which we're going to get into a little bit of the transition into the fine art world, is still theartofsmear.com,
right?
Correct, if I have it
right.
Right. So it stayed with you long enough that it's, my goodness, it's part of who you are, isn't it?
No, it really is. It becomes you in a lot of ways. This whole graffiti thing, the whole graffiti persona, it sort of takes over your life, a lot of aspects of your life. It's who you identify yourself as. It's really strange. It's kind of subtle at first, you know, you don't really notice it, but then over the years, as it progresses, it's like a vine. It just takes root, and then even if you want to, there's been periods of time when I want to quit or whatever, and then it's not easy. You think it'd be like, oh, it's not a big thing, but it's really hard to cut those bonds, you know.
Yeah. So, what's unusual about yourself, and it seems as though this is becoming more common as of recently, is that your identity and who you were was outed by the media.
Right.
And folks knew who you were overnight. Can you tell
us
a little bit about that transition? Because that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't happy about it, to be totally honest with you. You know, one moment you're going about doing your thing, you know, Smear, you know, under the cover of darkness, you know, scurrying around, all that kind of stuff. All of a sudden, boom, everybody knows who you are. Your whole, your name, your identity, your whole, that advantage you have has been totally stripped away from you, and you're kind of left there defenseless, naked, and, you know, with the big old bright light shining on you. And it was really hard. It was kind of traumatic. I mean, even now, I had to like kind of reinvent and redefine what Smear was to me. You know what I mean? I really had to sit there and look at it from a different point of view. I'm still kind of pissed off about it. That they kind of just took it away from me. I can't operate you know, that way anymore, and not as efficiently as I did, especially
mm-hmm.
in the city of Los Angeles. Maybe to some other town, I'll still be able to get away with something. But here, I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. So can you take us through how that happened for folks who aren't familiar with the news story?
Well, in 2007, the groundwork was set for that thing in 2009. I mean, 2007, I was in bed early in the morning, as most people are, and there was a series of really loud banging on the front door, with yelling. And I was still asleep, so I heard it, but I heard it like in a dream state. And then the phone started ringing by my bed. I picked it up, and I was still half asleep, mind you, basically more asleep than awake. And I just heard, Sheriff's Department, open the fucking door, open the door. And then, with the phone call and the banging outside, finally hit me like, oh man, dude, it's the cops, so I jumped out of bed, stumbling around, looking for some pants or pajamas or whatever, bottoms to put on and a shirt, and I went to open my back door, and they had already cut the chain on the front gate, I guess, in the driveway, and they were already at my back door. I guess I wasn't opening the front door in a timely fashion, fast enough for them. So they decided to cut the gate open. So when I opened the back door, man, I was putting on a jacket. I was like, I had one hand inside the jacket, the other one kind of like still out, trying to get it in. And I just, all these like cops were out there, like all over the place with guns pointed, and like all these little red beams were like, caressing my body or whatever. I was like, whoa, Then, stand down, get on your knees, and they grabbed me all roughly, and drug me to the front of the house in the driveway. And these guys had like flak jackets on, they had helmets with visors on, and big assault rifle type guns, and besides just the guys with handguns, there was like a whole percentage of them. There was about, I would say, 17 sheriffs there, and out of those 17, I would say about 8 of them were in like riot gear with big old assault rifle.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it was really, I was like, wow, I mean, I had a feeling it was about graffiti, but I was just kind of like thinking, even in my groggy state, I was like, wow, this seems like overkill, like the way they went about it, it was just a little much,
Mm-hmm.
And so, they cuffed me really, really tightly, and the guy asked me, do you know what this is about? And I just said, I have a feeling. He goes, what do you think it's about? And I didn't say anything, of course, I was just,
mm-hmm.
I just stayed quiet and like whatever. And they just proceeded to run through the house, ransacking everything, making a mess out of whatever they can make a mess of, like it was horrible. Afterwards, when I saw what kind of devastation they left, I was like, man, it just seems so overwhelming to try to put everything back together. Like, but that's another story that comes later on. But anyway, they cuffed me up. They sat me there for a long time while they were, going through, do whatever they were going through, photographing stuff, taking stuff, looking through everything, going through the garage, going through my car. And then they proceeded to take a bunch of my paintings, man. All the paintings I had in 2007 were like 30-something pieces, big, small, in between. They brought this pickup truck, this open bed pickup truck from the sheriff's department, and they just loaded it up with all my artwork. It was kind of weird. I was kind of surreal. Like, wow, like Nazi Germany, when they, they take art and they destroy and bonfires and book burnings and all that kind of stuff. That's what I was thinking about. Like, wow, this is like kind of like trippy, like an art, like a weird art bust, Like, anyway, so then they took me to the station. And Linwood Station, the sheriff's station, which is also serves as the women's jail facility. Funny, but that's like, I guess that's where the sheriff's department graffiti task force is housed. That's their headquarters. So they took me there, interrogation, they had my phone book, they started asking me this and that, and showing me pictures, and had some Polaroids of my ex-girlfriend naked that I used for, drawing her for some art class I took for a short period of time, and, you know, it was that hot chick in the pictures, you know, I was like, oh, that's my ex-girlfriend. You know, later on, I had like three of them, that cop stole two of them, you know, I only got one back, so that's kind of creepy right there, just to show you what kind of people they are. And basically, you know, they sent me off to county, you know, got a lawyer. I was put on a probation, a suspended prison sentence, which is basically I pled no contest, so they charged me with, I was charged with 17 felonies and 4 misdemeanors all in one day. So with that, they charged me with four felonies, but I still, as far as restitution goes, I would still be responsible for the other felonies, but I just wouldn't be, they wouldn't hit me with them because of the deal. So I wouldn't face as much time. So I was only facing 4 years. So, but the judge convicted me to 4 years of prison, but suspended it. You know, if I promised not to get in any more trouble of any sort. And you know, they try to give me the provision that I can't have any art supplies. My lawyer struck it down, saying that I'm a artist, and you know, art graffiti supplies is a really vague term, which can encompass anything. So they struck that, so I could have my graffiti supplies. So after this, everything was cool. In 2008, everything was like, you know, pretty chill. And then in 2009, they started raiding me again for probation compliance checks, just random, you know, sweeps. And they would always raid my house again early in the morning and banging on the doors, coming in, tossing everything up and down, cuffing me, taking me outside, looking for anything that they could violate me for. And they always try to violate me for art supplies, like tubes of acrylic. I've been taken to jail for tubes of watercolor paint, if you could believe that. They would yeah, exactly. I don't know how you're gonna manage to do graffiti with watercolor paint, but I don't know. They would bust me for basically anything, and whenever I try to tell them, like, hey man, why don't you check the paperwork? I have it in my drawer. The lawyer said that I can have quote unquote graffiti supplies, art supplies, and they just, you know, said basically what they would always say was like, tell it to the judge, you know? Which is what I did. I would have to go to jail for X amount of days, you know, and then kind of stressing it because if the judge wasn't seeing it my way, I would be violated and do the 4 years. But, you know, the judges were mostly like, yeah, you know, they saw that with the provisions stated, I was in violation, boom, go home. This went on for a bit. And then in 2009, what was it? Actually, this was in early 2009 when they came and they tried to bust me for that river, LA River, that big MTA roller thing in the LA River.
Yeah, so this is the 2008 MTA tag that you're talking about.
Gigantic. The MTA crew, I guess, painted it in the riverbed at some point in 2008, right? Yeah. And I had seen it beforehand online, because I used to run MTA crew a long time ago in the past. I hadn't been from MTA crew since early 2003, by my recollections. And so I had a passing curiosity about the big MTA. I was like, wow, it's huge, you know. So I, you know, looked it online, but it was nothing like, you know, wow. Then yeah, in 2009, February, January, whatever it was, they raided me. And then, you know, I thought it was another probation checkup. I thought it was another probation sweep. And then they take me to the police station, the Linwood station, and start asking me about the MTA roller. And they go, who did the MTA roller? And I was like, well, I would assume the MTA crew did, right? They didn't like that answer, you know, why is that? You know, they got kind of mad, threatening. We know you were there. Tell us who was there. And I was like, man, I haven't been from MTA since forever, dude. I have no idea who was there, you know, whatever. I had nothing to do with it. I stuck to it because it was the truth. I had nothing to do with it. I did not know who did it. So they kept badgering me, whatever. Took me to county again. ended up come court date, I still kind of didn't really know what the hell it was really about, to be totally honest. I was still kind of vague on the details until the day of the court date, the scheduled court date. I saw all the co-defendants, like all the MTA guys, walking in the holding cell where I was, like a whole bunch of them, you know, guys I knew and guys I had never seen before because they were new. They got put down after I got out in 2003. And I was like, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, hey, what's up, man? What's up, Samir? You don't know? I was like, no, what, man? Like, newspaper, MTA, you know, big roller, that's what we're here for, blah, blah, blah. That's when it kind of dawned on me, like, what was really going on. I was like, oh, shit, this isn't just some, like, compliance check. This is, like, a whole new thing they're trying to charge me with or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I was like, fuck. So we're sitting there in the holding cell, stressing, you know, talking, you know, bullshitting, whatever. And then the closer it drew to us having to go see the judge, you know, the lawyers would come in and go, you know what, they haven't even filed it. The city hasn't filed a case yet. If they don't file by 5 o'clock, you guys are all walking. So we just kept waiting. They hadn't filed. They didn't file, and they didn't end up filing the case until 5 o'clock. So the case was automatically dismissed, the criminal aspect of it. So everybody thought we're going home, but no, you know, I had a probation hold, so I had to go. The probation officer had to like review my case because I got arrested or whatever. So they had to like see if I was in violation. Another guy there had a parole hold. Another guy there, when they went to his house, he had like a bunch of marijuana. Another guy had like some INS hold. So I don't know if anybody actually went home that day, but I didn't, and a few other guys didn't. So again, I had to stay there like about another, I don't know, 4 days or a week until the whole probation thing got cleared up, and then I finally went home. Thought nothing of it anymore, you know, went on living my life. You know, the raids kept on coming periodically. Over 2009 was a pretty hectic one. They come every few months, especially before I had, like, an art show or something. Like, they would know, and they came, like, a week before, try to mess my, you know, my flow up. Anyway, basically, in 2010, they came to my house one last time, you know, banged on the door, not as harshly this time. I was with a girl in bed. I was like, oh, man, you know, whatever. I got put through some pants on, went to the gate. You know, I knew the procedure by this time. Like, oh, no need to open the door. They stuck this thick sheaf of papers at me, and they said, you've been served. And I was like, what the hell? It was like a real thick stack, man. I came back in the house and looked at the paperwork, you know, Superior Court of, you know, Los Angeles versus MTA. My name's on it. All this stuff, and I was like in shock. I was like in disbelief. Like, what is this? You know, I thought this MTA thing was like over with. I thought, you know, I didn't have to deal with it. There was no criminal charges filed. So then I figured out it was a civil suit. I was like stressed out. I told the girl, you know, go home, get dressed, get out of here, whatever. And proceeded to make phone calls. You know, called my friend's dad as a lawyer, but he's like a will, like an estate lawyer, you know, so he kind of advised me, but he didn't really, that's not his specialty, so he just kind of like, he told me to make copies of, he made copies of it at his office and told me like, you know, hit up this, you know, mail it out to this, mail out to this. So I started doing research and stuff, mail it out to ACLU, mailed it out to the First Amendment Project out in Oakland, even went out to Oakland to meet with the dude, he wasn't there, it was like whatever, but anyway, the ACLU tentatively kind of picked it up, but then some other law firm picked it up. Anyway, basically, I had to go through a lot of law firms. ACLU finally took the case. We fought it out. You know, it was, like, really stressful. It was really hectic. Carmen Tatanich, you know, and his crazy, you know how he operates, right? The whole, he villainized everything, you know. Basically, he tried to make protesting on the sidewalk, which is a God-given right to any American, right? You know, if something's wrong, you protest, but he tried to make that a misdemeanor, trying to, you know, like crazy things, just like absurd things. Like he basically took the Constitution, or is trying to, and his shit on it, you know, lit it on fire, threw some kerosene on it and watched it burn and danced around it with a wicked grin, I guess, you know, like some pagan ritual. The First Amendment doesn't, like, the Constitution in general doesn't seem to hold any water for him. But yeah, so you know, we fought it out. It was hard going, it was stressful, it was really crazy. It was like, you know, I felt I was like in, you know, a Kafka story, you know. It was and then finally now, after, you know, a few long years, it's finally over. It's finally at the end, and I'm free of it. I knew it was ridiculous. I knew it was bullshit. I knew it was insane and absurd, but I was just shocked that other people, the courts, the system, the public at large didn't see the injustice of it, the absurdity of it, you know? I mean, people at large, I guess, just think, you know, graffiti writers, you know, fuck you, you know, you guys are doing this and that. But I was thinking, this isn't just about me. This is about the First Amendment. This is about, you know, the spirit of America in a lot of ways. This is just a small thing. You got to stand up for it, because then your rights, you're even if you're, you know, church going goody goody two shoes or whatnot, your rights are going to be stripped next. It's not going to be graffiti. It's going to be something else. This is just them testing the waters. Another test. They do a lot of these things, pushing how far they can stretch, how far they could ignore the Constitution. This is just another one of those tests. And people, no matter what it is, people should be up in arms immediately and appalled and just stop this. You know, they should rise up for anything like this. You know,
It's a crazy story as you're telling it, because I hadn't heard it in detail from you before, and it is something straight out of a movie. It's certainly from my perspective, so on the outside, there's a power of the press in all of this as well, and you alluded to that, because first of all, these recent events are just like really recent. You're finally off. You know, everything is, this whole MTA charge is gone. There's a big report in LA Times about it. But it's interesting, every time the LA Times reported something on this, they always listed Smear. And yeah. I don't recall any other writer or artist or street artist or graffiti artist ever being listed in any of those charges, etc. So your name really got dragged through the mud through all of this. And perhaps maybe that's part of also being a media darling in a way. I know you've been, the press has also sort of held you up also as a great artist as well. And so that was part of sort of losing that identity as Smear. Yeah, so it is this strange, I mean, it's an unfortunate series of events, and I'm happy for you that it's over. And we talked a little bit before the show, and you're obviously really relieved about all of it. So
relieved,
and going forward, what's that? Go say again.
No, so relieved. I can't even put it into words.
Oh yeah, I know. I can hear it in your voice, and even the way you're able to talk about it, it seems much more free. And obviously, you still have this anger and this frustration through all this, and rightly so. Anybody would. But yeah, it's a huge relief that it's over. So, and one of the things you mentioned, and this is also when you Google your name or you do some research on Smear, you get into your fine artwork, you get into your paintings that are a bit expressionistic. They mix a lot of pop culture, a lot of pop elements, cartoons, things of that sort. Can you tell us a bit about that transition? Because you are very productive as a painter, and the lines between graffiti, street art, and the fine art world are very thin, and that's something that I'm interested in. But I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that transition and what you're doing now.
Well, the fine art thing, the art appreciation was always there since I was a kid. You know, my dad was like a small-time, like he would go to like garage sales and thrift stores back in the 80s, and he'd find little treasures hidden amongst the trash, right? He had all these like little art books and price guides and art history books and all this kind of like painters and California painters lists and names and all, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, and he always had all these like little, you know, knickknacks, like little paintings, little sculptures, little, just all kinds of little stuff, like basically junk. But, you know, I thought as a kid, this kind of stuff is gonna, of course, it's there, it's accessible, it's like you soak it all in. And I was always like, you know, pouring through the art books and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I kind of had this whole thing for the art before even the graffiti, but I just never really considered or thought of me actually engaging in the art. But then, you know, the graffiti thing, I just fell into it because of the people I was around. And then as time progressed, you know, just writing on stuff and doing all that kind of stuff. In 2005, for some reason, I had been toying with the idea for a while, But then I just said, why not? Why not try my hands at it? Why not try my hand at it? Like, what do these people have that I don't have, you know? These artists I admire and like that I held up on a pedestal and like, you know? So I just decided to throw my hat in the ring and, you know, have a go at it or whatever. And I remember I told this girl I was with, my ex-girlfriend at the time, I told her, like, you know, I was doodling on a piece of paper and I told her, you know what, I want to become an artist. Just like that. That was just it, basically. That's when it came out. That's when I heard myself say it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then she just looked at me and like, you're going to become an artist, you know? And then I was like, whoa, you know, that kind of hurt. And then, you know, my phone rang. Friend was a mutual friend of ours was on there. She's like, what's Chris doing? She's like, oh, Chris, well, he's gonna become an artist. And I was like, wow, what a fucking cunt, you know? I just wanted to, like,
oh my gosh, that's a terrible thing to hear.
Yeah, I was like, wow, like, you know, kill a dream. So needless to say, she wasn't around very much longer after that. And you know, I just started learning on my own, man. I didn't have any training. I didn't know anything about mediums, you know, what to use, what goes with what. So I just started screwing around on a shitty old, the back of a crappy old baseball poster that I bought when I was walking down the street for like 50 cents from a garage sale. And I just, you know, took it out of its like crappy little glass frame. I was thinking I could flip it around and paint on it and use the glass frame that it was in and stuff. And, you know, I would have like my first piece, but no, it didn't work out that way. It was like taped up. It was really cheap. So when I untaped it or whatever, the frame wasn't usable anymore. So I was like, crap, but whatever, I still use the piece. And it was just really crappy, whatever. It was a really crappy piece. And I just gave it away to somebody recently and it was kind of torn. I had it like, but whatever. And then I kept on trying and trying. I bought some oil colors. I wanted to, you know, use oil. I bought an oil color set with like a little, you know, canvas board. Try to go at it. It just came out like a big muddy mess, you know. I was like, wow, you know. And I was like really disappointed. I just stuck at it. I could have just given up. I was thinking of just giving up. Like, oh, I'm not gonna be any good at this. But you know, I just kept trying. I started going and getting like art books from the library, like, you know, techniques and how to, and learning about mediums. And I had friends that were, you know, of course, graffiti writers that were doing, you know, art stuff, and they went to art school. So I started like asking them stuff, and they would help me out. And like, I didn't know how to collage. I always thought collage was amazing, but I didn't know how the fuck to do it. I was like using like spray, like 3M spray adhesive, and doing it, and it was kind of tacky and weird, and didn't feel right. And they're like, nah, man, use gloss or matte medium. And I was like, oh wow, you know, like that opened up a whole other world for me, and just all this kind of stuff. And so little by little, then I took a few art classes, like a beginning drawing and a two-dimensional design class, and you know, didn't stick with them, dropped them. I took those classes a shitload of times before I actually like passed them. You know, I just go, I would drop them, and cause I don't like school. Go back, take them some more, and then I ended up taking like an oil and acrylic painting class, which again I didn't go very far, and I dropped them. I told the teacher, I can't do this. I can't paint in the classroom full of people. You know, I paint a lot less now in class than I do at home, and the teacher's cool. He's like, you're already an artist. You don't have to come to class. Just paint, and you know, bring me your when you're ready. Show me your work, and I'll grade you like that. You can just do it at home. And I was like, wow, really? He was a really cool teacher, man. But I didn't even take him up on it. I'm not going to pretend like I did. He gave me the greatest, most lenient, you know, classroom experience I could have had, and I still like didn't take it up. I just kind of like, whatever. I didn't show him the work or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, but then that's how it started, man. So, you know, right now I just kept pushing and I started, you know, getting a feel for it, always going to art shows, art galleries, museums, and studying, you know, really looking at paintings. When I made an artist at a show, I'd ask him, like, I wouldn't ask him like, what were you thinking, what did you feel, and all that kind of, I would ask him, what did you use, you know, what's this, like, what's that, like, how did you do that, what's that glaze, and all that kind of stuff, what's it on, you know. How long did it take? How long did it take to dry? And like, and you know, I try, you know, all that kind of stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a curious mind that has to drive it forward to become an artist, because there's a lot of technique and there's a lot of tradition in there, and it sounds as though as you came up against the problems, you sought out ways to solve it. But what I find most interesting about you is this identity as an artist probably started when you were a kid. you saw yourself, or as a younger person saw yourself as an artist first. The writing or graffiti or street art came later as an interest in the visual arts, and then it sort of comes back on the other end, doesn't it, in a more traditional sense with your work now. So it's an interesting arc, if you will, as a story. Yeah, so in going forward, you know, with you're obviously, you've done a few shows, you're in a few galleries. What do you see next for you?
I mean, honestly, what I see next is just keep on doing it, expand, growing more. Like I just want to be that artist. You know, I have my own personal hang-ups. Like, I'm not very social. I have, like, these, like, I'm kind of like a caveman. I like to be a hermit. I like to not go out. I know I have to get over that and, like, be more social, shake more hands, you know, kiss more babies. Like a politician, you know, you got to be out there meeting the right people. I got to do that more. So, and it's just so easy for me not to do that. It's so easy for me just, like, sit at home and paint, read a book, you know, watch a good movie or documentary. That's what I like to do. You know, I'm not, like, one of those out there kind of guys. But I got to do that and just push it. That's my goal now. Just push it, meet more people, do more things, you know, like get more into the mix, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I understand, of course,
keep painting and growing, experimenting. I'm always experimenting. I feel like I found something kind of new, a new direction. Not too long ago, if you've seen some of my new paintings, like with the Batman and like Superman, like, you know, the garbage, but like slightly more well rendered, I guess, like the mm-hmm. pop elements, but like more, they're not as expressionistic now. I mean, that stuff is still there in the background, but kind of like, you know, the images are clearer, I guess, and but it still has that funky vibe to it, that whole like expressionistic, you know, like I don't care, like just like accidental stuff, but it also more thought out, more refined type of stuff. So that's the direction I'm going in right now. I just kind of started doing it late last year, but I really started like turning out more pieces this year, and I'm kind of liking the direction. But at the same time, I'm also doing like work that I guess would be classified almost as abstract expressionistic, you know, more that realm, more expressionistic, more. So I'm kind of working on this because I like that stuff. I've always liked that. I mean, I know it's not that cool anymore or whatever. It's like old man art or whatever. It's like, you know, that's so old. So like, you know, but I've always liked that stuff. I always liked the Kooning and Pollock and these guys. These guys are my heroes, man. Like these Klein and all these dudes. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So,
well, they're original American rebels, especially someone like Jackson Pollock, and there's a certain myth to them. And you're right, your work does have that expressionistic feel to it, but you also mix elements of realism and found images that does make it much more fresher, and it's not dark and broody like abstract expressionism, so it doesn't feel old in that way. So from my perspective, is when I critique it, that's how I see it. Does look fresher and it does look new and contemporary. So I think that's a good thing.
Cool.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add to that?
I mean, like I said, I like the past. I mean, I like the art history. I like that. There's so much you could just dip into, you know. And you know, all my favorite artists are dead guys, you know. And so yeah, I mean, of course, you know, there's content, but I try to like kind of take that all the stuff, like the history from the past, and kind of like, you know, digest it, and then of course with the new, my own spin on it. Of course, it's gonna be new because I'm here, I'm now, I'm contemporary, I'm modern, I'm here. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to like kind of like take that back history and like, you know, like revamp it, I guess, so to speak, you know, bring it forward, because I don't really do like the, you know, like a lot of people are using stencils and all that and silk screening and all that kind of stuff. I stay away from that. I'm not going to talk bad about it, but it's just not for me. I don't dig it. I think it's kind of crappy, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, for street art, yeah, stencils and all that stuff is cool for the streets, but when somebody tries to put that on canvas, I would just walk by a quote unquote painting like that, and I wouldn't even give it a second glance, to be totally honest. I just kind of look at it like whatever, like, you know, I won't even acknowledge it.
I understand exactly what you mean, and for listeners, which will direct them to your website, is that a lot of street art galleries, a lot of street artists that make that transition into the gallery, it's the same imagery. It's the same stencil as you're talking about, or just reminiscent of it in some sort of way. And with your work, you really don't have any evidence of that at all. And a lot of times when you take that thing from the street, it's that context of the street makes it powerful, whether it's simple or whatever. When you bring it in the gallery, it does look like a caged animal in some ways, or it just doesn't command the attention. And your work really does. It looks like, they look like paintings that belong in a gallery, and they're nothing like the work that I know of you from the street. So I think that's probably a good place to end. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Well, so hold on a second, Samir. So I just want to thank folks for listening to the Stay Up podcast. And if folks want to learn more about Samir, where should they go?
They should go to my website, theartofsamir.com. Or just Google me, you know, Christian Gyurgyu, Christian Samir Gyurgyu. I mean, that's a tough name, but whatever. Yeah, the website.
Okay, cool. And thanks again for writing that forward. It's pretty fantastic. It really puts the reader in the driver's seat. So I think it was a pretty phenomenal job. So thanks again for doing that.
No problem. That was my pleasure.
Yeah, so if you're interested in learning about future guests or want to participate in the show, please visit our Facebook page. It's called Stay Up Los Angeles Street Art. But until then, stay tuned for more episodes, and we'll let the music by Desire Obtain Cherish take us out. Thanks so much.
Thank you.